This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for your grace and mercy to us. And we want to have self-control ourselves, be self-disciplined, so that we can also help others to have lives that are orderly. And pray your blessing on the teachers here, that they would have courage and wisdom in matters of discipline, help us to prevent problems as much as possible, and then deal with problems as they arise in a kind and judicious and effective way. Bless this workshop together, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. From Dr. Dobson, Dare to Discipline, let me read about two teachers and then have you evaluate them. One teacher is called Miss Peach, and she gives a little talk to her class. "I'm so glad we have a chance to get together. This is going to be such a fun year for you. We're going to make soap and soup, and we're going to paint a mural that'll cover that entire wall. We'll take field trips, and we'll play games. This is going to be a great year. You're going to love me, and I'm going to love you, and we'll just have a ball." Her curriculum is well saturated with fun activities, which are her tokens of affection to her class. All goes well the first day of school because the students are a little intimidated by the start of a new academic year. But about 3 days later, little Butch is sitting over on the left, and he wants to know what everyone else is questioning. How far can we push Miss Peach? He's anxious to make a name for himself as a brave toughie, and he might be able to build his reputation at Miss Peach's expense. At a well-calculated moment, he challenges her with a small act of defiance. Now, the last thing Miss Peach wants is conflict. She had hoped to avoid that sort of thing. She does not accept Butch's challenge. She pretends not to notice that he didn't do what she told him to do. He wins this first minor issue. Everyone in the class saw what had happened. It wasn't a big deal, but Butch survived unscathed. The next day, Matthew has been greatly encouraged by Butch's success. He defies her a little more openly than Butch did, and Miss Peach again ignores the challenge. From that moment forward, chaos begins to grow and intensify. 2 weeks later, Miss Peach is beginning to notice that things are not going very well. She's doing a lot of screaming each day, and she doesn't know how it got started. She certainly didn't intend to be a violent teacher. By February, life has become intolerable in her classroom. Every new project she initiates is sabotaged by her lack of control. And then the thing she wanted least begins to happen. The students openly reveal their hatred and contempt of her. They call her names. They laugh at her weaknesses. If she has a physical flaw, such as a large nose or poor eyesight, they point this out to her regularly. Miss Peach cries quietly at recess time, and her head throbs and pounds late into the night. The principal comes in and witnesses the anarchy, and he says, "Miss Peach, you must get control of this class." But Miss Peach doesn't know how to get control because she doesn't know how she lost it. Now then, let's visit Miss Justice's classroom, Mrs. Justice. She wants the love of the class, too, but she's more keenly aware of her responsibility to the students. On the first day of school, she delivers her inaugural address, but it's very different from the one spoken by Miss Peach. She says, in effect, "This is going to be a good year, and I'm glad you are my students. I want you to know that each of you is important to me. I hope you will feel free to ask your questions and enjoy learning in this class. I will not allow anyone to laugh at you, because it hurts to be laughed at. I will never embarrass you intentionally, and I want to be your friend. But there's one thing you should know. If you choose to challenge me, I have 1,001 ways to make you miserable. If you don't believe me, just let me know and we'll start with number one." Now, I actually don't encourage that particular challenge, at least not to adolescent students. I've seen teachers give something, it backfires, so maybe with younger students you can get by with that. But anyway, you get the point. but I don't know if I would say it to students, certainly not the ones I teach in grade 7 to 10. Your parents have given me the responsibility of teaching you some very important things this year, and I have to get you ready for the knowledge you'll learn next year. That's why I can't let one or two show-offs keep me from doing my job. We have a lot to learn, so I think we'd better get started. Please get out your math books and turn to page 4. Well, of course, you would have a point of contact and all that sort of thing, but not in this story. About 3 days later, Butch's counterpart is on the job. There's at least one Butch in every classroom. If the classroom antagonist leaves during the year, a new demagogue will emerge to prominence. He challenges Mrs. Justice in a cautious manner, and she socks it to him. He loses big. Everyone in the class gets the message. It doesn't pay to attack Mrs. J. This poor Butch didn't do so well, did he? Well, Mrs. Justice then proceeds to follow a little formula, this don't smile till Thanksgiving deal. By November, October in Canada, this competent teacher has made her point. The class knows she's tougher, wiser, and braver than they are. Then she can begin to enjoy the pleasure of this foundation. She can loosen her control. The class can laugh together, talk together, and play together. But when Mrs. Justice says, it's time to get back to work, they do it because they know she is capable of enforcing her suggestion. She does not scream. She does not hit. In fact, she can pour out the individual affection that most children need so badly. The class responds with deep love that will never be forgotten in those 32 lives. Mrs. Justice has harvested the greatest source of satisfaction available in the teaching profession, awareness of profound influence on human lives. My question? What points about discipline do these two stories illustrate? Pick up your pen. You've got a paper now. Anyone without a handout? Still need one here? Two? We've made some more. Raise your hand again. Here we go. And write down one thing that you conclude from hearing those stories. Go ahead and write down briefly on wherever you have space on the paper. Okay, you've got a thought there. I don't care if you've written it down completely or not. I'd like you to find a partner not too far from you and compare the lessons that you think of. So take a few moments now and start talking to each other. If you can find someone that looks fairly sociable, not too far from you. And do you want to come back here? You can work in groups of two or three. I'm glad to have you at the front, but there's nobody there to talk to. Okay, thank you very much. Sound a little disorderly. Actually, just a nice hubbub of sound that is quite pleasing to my ear. 1 Corinthians 14 says, what is the last verse? Let all things be done decently and in order. So, our topic today is discipline, preventive, and some people say preventative. I generally say preventive and corrective. I'd like to think, first of all, of how we can understand misbehavior. So, let's think of some factors that contribute to misbehavior or good behavior on the positive side. Heredity is one. Now, we can't do a whole lot about heredity of our students, but we can at least understand how it can impact the classroom. You know, there's a debate whether it's heredity or environment that makes the difference. The basic problem is parental, our first parents, Adam and Eve. And you know how they raised Cain, which means to create a disturbance. And the nice thing about heredity is that there can be a second birth, which impacts the classroom tremendously in older grades. And I've seen the beauty of people changing drastically. or other teachers saying, has Caitlin become a Christian? She seems so different. Well, yeah, she is different. She has a new nature. Some physical influences now. The Monday morning syndrome, the lack of sleep, when students may be touchy or stubborn or irritable, or maybe it's more a reflection of the teacher. You know, the student should not be able to tell when the teacher had a late date the night before. Students' health. I had a couple students who both needed kidney transplants. And leading up to that, they were rather draggy. And I could not expect the same thing out of them as I could if they didn't have this kidney problem. Infected tonsils, sluggish thyroid, things like that. A student's help can affect behavior. Thirdly, skipping breakfast can affect alertness. I think it's impact some people, adults and children, more than others. I remember in grade 2, I had a fellow student who ate crayons. I don't know if it was a breakfast problem or if he just wanted more colorful speech. But anyhow, maybe there's a defect in one of the senses. A hearing problem, so the person seems to be disobedient. They just didn't hear the instruction, so naturally they couldn't obey. Maybe it's poor vision so that the student tires in reading, and so it's more fun to bother their neighbors. Back to breakfast, I have a son-in-law, Stephen Gingrich, who was here about 4 years ago, and they have a school of about 250 students in El Chal, community children, just about all of them. Few Christian Anabaptist families there, very few. And mid-morning, they give a breakfast, some food, helps the learning. So we've looked at heredity, physical influences, now home influences. There's variation of standards of discipline. Some parents are very strict. Some parents train their children to respond only after hearing the instruction two or three times, or after the parent has raised their voice, you do this or else. Well, the first time they're told to put their toys away, well, nothing happens because nothing happened before. So there's variations within homes. Or some parents will bargain with their children, so students learn, or they think that they can bargain with their teachers and make some deals. A lack of emotional security, and because they don't feel good about themselves, they don't feel secure emotionally, they compensate for their inadequacy by trying to gain the attention of others and so boost their self-esteem by having their peers say how neat it was, how they got away with something in the classroom. Thirdly, an only child. How many of you are an only child in a family? There's no spoiled children here at all. That's wonderful. Anyway, that's the reputation. It doesn't necessarily work. I don't know if there's a greater tendency. Those of us who came from a family of six, maybe we a little more critical of that. But I've noticed some very well-behaved children who were the only child in the home. So, however, they may have more difficulty relating to other people. Other classmates. Maybe there's a new baby arrives in a home, and so the child who's used to getting a lot of attention from their parents doesn't get nearly as much attention, so they may exhibit some antisocial tendencies. There could be conflict between parents if the mom and dad had a big verbal fight, an argument at breakfast time. Maybe there's financial anxieties. I've taught children already where one of the parents had a terminal illness. And unless the Lord intervened with a miracle, we all knew that the home was going to be fatherless in a matter of months. So those things can affect behavior in a classroom. parental speech. By that I mean if the parent is critical of the teacher, then the children in the family are more likely to disrespect the teacher. If the parents disparage the teacher, then children are likely, will have tendencies not to have respect for their teacher. Seventh, undue pressure on children. There are some parents who expect a junior to be a budding Einstein. Well, yeah, in terms of intelligence, I heard the other day that Einstein was the one. He was a smoker, pipe smoker. Is that the way you see him pictured? Anyhow, he would go around and pick up cigarette butts and then fill his pipe. So, clearly saving, I guess. Doesn't sound like the brightest chap in the world to me, but anyhow. And so parents may expect high grades from their children, and they may bribe them, as it were, give them money if they get, and so there's a tendency to cheat in order to accomplish the goals. My parents were not like that. I remember my youngest sister. She declared she was she said, I'm the first dumbest in the class. So she was first, at least, in something. And that didn't seem to bother my mom and dad. There may be inappropriate attention seeking at home, and so they transfer that to the school. So Tommy may be unsuccessful in academics, but he's very successful in troublemaking and getting the attention. So it's a good idea to find an area of interest for Tommy, give him recognition. I tend to, usually have some boys that like to tinker. So then they're often not the most academically minded. But I have different things that go wrong. My stapler doesn't work, or there's something that needs a repair in the classroom. I'll just hand it to them or ask them to fix it. And they feel good about it, and I feel good about it. Oftentimes, I'll give a less academically inclined boy the responsibility to make sure that all the sports equipment have been collected from outside the school and neatly organized. And that gives them some attention and good feeling about their contribution. Any comments or questions so far about understanding discipline issues? Number six, parental speech. Anything else that you'd like clarified? Let's think next about preventing discipline problems by love. Love shows sympathy as well as kindness. Now, when I started teaching at my present school, there was a little fellow in grade one. He fell in the mud. I saw it. I went and picked him up and comforted him a bit, and he went home and told his parents that Brother Bean, that's my name at school, is such a kind man. And that wasn't a bad reputation to have, especially since it was the church leader's son that had the little fellow. But we have students who have been muddied by poor hygiene or personality flaws or idiosyncrasies of one sort or another. The fruit of the Spirit, which should be evident in a teacher's life, one of that is gentleness or kindness. Those who deserve love least need it the most. Think about that in your class. Those who deserve love least need it the most. So, love. Three different aspects I'd like to speak about, especially. Love shows sympathy as well as kindness. I remember the day that I received a phone call from a home. Had a couple children in my class from that home. Father was using his skid steer. He didn't see the preschooler. Ran over the preschooler and killed him. I couldn't expect the same attention and work ethic from those students. Their minds would be other places. So, kindness. Secondly, love prompts a teacher to admit mistakes and apologize. We heard that from Brother Linford this morning. I got angry. I didn't speak very graciously, and I'm sorry. Or I embarrassed you. I'm sorry. I made a mistake in totaling your test score. Sorry about that. The one teacher who wouldn't acknowledge any mistakes, if he made a mistake on the chalkboard and students would observe it and tell him, he'd say, oh, I did that on purpose just to see if you were watching, if you'd catch it. That was a big fake. They knew it. They did not respect him because he couldn't admit that he made mistakes. So, love prompts a teacher to admit mistakes and apologize. And love gives words of commendation. I try to follow the rule of, for every criticism I make of a student, there's going to be 10 words, 10 times of commendation. For every criticism, 10 commendations. When there's appreciation, when a student feels appreciated, they feel more secure, they feel more motivated, and when they feel secure and motivated, they have fewer discipline problems as a general rule. How many of you have your Bibles here this morning? Okay, scattering of them. If you look in the epistles of Paul, even a church like Corinth that was full of problems, just about every epistle he writes, he starts off with commendation. He expresses his appreciation, what they do well, and how pleased he is with them, and so on. It happens over and over again. I could have mentioned point D, but I forgot it, actually. I admit my mistake. So if you want to add D here, love points to Christ. And so when students are pointed to Christ, sometimes it is something that's said in class, a devotional or something, that gets them thinking about conversion. But love points to Christ, and when there's genuine conversion, then there's that's really, when there's conversion, it's the best way to prevent discipline problems, because there's an inner motivation and power to demonstrate Christ-like behavior. Let's go on to some more methods of preventive discipline. First thing is to pray. So let's have you think now of some things that a teacher does well to pray, either before or during class, or before the school year or during the school year. What are some people or situations, needs that a teacher could pray for? I'd like you to talk to each other now, so get in a group of two or three and just say some things to each other, what it would be good to pray for. Go ahead, talk about that. All right, thank you very much. Sorry to interrupt you, but you got the idea there. Some teachers like to sit in the desks, the chairs of the students, and pray for them before school or after school. Who is the Mennonite school teacher a couple hundred years ago who prayed for his students and died on his knees praying for his students, presumably? Say it together.
Christopher Dodd.
Now, teachers are often put on the spot by infractions of the rules, sometimes things you never thought of before. Sometimes there are difficulties you've encountered before, but some are unique. So I have a tendency, at least if it's anything serious at all, to not make a snap decision, but rather to say, remain at recess, or I want to talk with you later. And that gives me a chance to pray about it. It's one of the reasons I do. The other reason is so if it could be taken as a personal affront to me, then it ruffles my feathers. It stirs my emotions. It gives me a chance to calm down if I'm riled up a bit by it. And teacher and students can always tell whether we are. We might say we're not angry, but our body language might say something different to them. So pray. Secondly, prepare. So if you're prepared for class, prepared for the day, it communicates a feeling of confidence. And that feeling of confidence then gets communicated to the students, and they feel more comfortable then, more secure, meaning fewer problems. So, a good introduction to a lesson, as many lessons as you can. Plan for variety in content and method. Preparation means you don't have to run to the supply room for something. You've got what you need there in class, and so you're not leaving the class unattended. Thirdly, minimize distractions. So, some of the distractions can be people moving around the room. I notice in my classroom that sometimes a foot needs to be stretched, the leg needs to be stretched just as a friend is walking by. And if they're cruising around the back of the room and to get a book or a library book or something, you know, just grab a friend's ear and poke somebody and have a little conversation. And, you know, it just invites. I'm not saying there shouldn't be movement in the classroom, but have it restricted to that which is necessary. Recess time, there should be lots of movement. I'm really a strong promoter of recess activities, organized recess activities. When I appeared at my present school, I noticed I was teaching the older grades, grades 4 to 9, and I noticed they hung around outside. Instead of getting a game going, they'd be leaning up against the school wall outside, and I can imagine the kind of stories they were sharing with each other and start goofing around. And I thought, I think we want to get some games going, and I enjoy athletic things very much. And I like to play hockey with my students and football and soccer and all this stuff. Don't do too much basketball because we don't have a gymnasium. Anyway, we got some games going, taught them some new games, and they, now it's it can be a little too much of a problem with the sports interest, and but it helps a lot to have movement outside the classroom, but not so much inside. If you can avoid discomforts in the classroom, a stuffy room, that affects the mood and the studying atmosphere. A flickering light, you know, if you have a light going on and off. A cool draft or a desk that's way too big or way too small for the student. Jesus, as he started his Sermon on the Mount, the Bible says, when he was set, he opened his mouth. Next, give clear instructions. A lot of disorder is caused when students really, what did he say? What is he supposed to be doing? And so they talk with each other and they question. So be explicit, be crystal clear as to what they're supposed to be doing. And as far as that goes, the first few days of school, clarify exactly what you expect of them and insist on it and develop those sorts of routines so you don't have to give instructions over and over and over again. And another key point is to another aspect of giving clear instructions is if there's a hubbub, noise, conversation, you know, at the beginning of a class, call for attention or ring a bell or whatever method you have, and then wait for everything to be totally quiet before you give the instructions. Otherwise, some don't hear, and so they're uncertain. It just promotes disorder. Next, maintain eye contact. So don't sit at the desk with your eyes down while who knows what is going on in the classroom, but rather, if you need to do some grading, one of my teachers, I don't think he ever sat down in the course of the day except to eat his lunch. He was just always walking around and on his feet. Depending on the type of class, if it's a individualized classroom, that's quite a different sort of thing. But if it's a classroom approach, then be on the move. And as you're talking, be observant of what's happening over here in the corner and what's happening, and meet their gaze if you can. And just there's something about eye contact. I read of one, I think it was somebody that told me this. I forget now, it's been a few years ago, but they said when they were bad, when they had to appear, they appeared before the teacher, the disciplinarian, he never used corporal punishment. The punishment was he got parked right in front of the teacher, and he was told, I don't know if he was told to look at the teacher or not, but the teacher looked at him. And for some reason or other, there seems to be a bit of a disconcerting feeling when a person in authority, and it's a little difficult. And students said they would much rather have taken a strapping, a whipping, than to have this teacher stare at them for I don't know how long. So maybe there is something about staring at a student that creates a desire to behave. Sixth, remember the value of, or F on your paper, remember the value of proximity. So, I notice this girl is having a little trouble staying at her work or behaving. She's whispering or goofing around. So I just come and stand here. Maybe don't say a whole lot. And usually they're pretty quick to get the point. By the way, you are doing fine. But there's something about that closeness that you don't have to say anything. Or maybe I'll, if it's a boy, and have a pretty good relationship with him most of the time, which is the way it is with Timothy. So I'll just, give a few light taps on the head. Wouldn't work in the public system probably, because you're supposed to never, well, I don't know about something like that, if that would work or not, but they're very, very careful about any physical contact. So, another thing is you can, if you know that somebody is likely to give you some problems, you might either assign seating or somehow arrange for the individual to be up close to you, just so there is that natural proximity. Summer Bible school, I've taught that for 40 years plus. And if I observe before 9 o'clock what's going on, I see somebody is hyperactive and a bit of a leader, then I'll say, I'd like you to help me hand out things or run errands for me or something like that. So you sit right up here, so I can have you real handy. And don't be afraid to reseat. Now, my arrangement for seating in the classroom will be in September, day after Labor Day is when we begin in Ontario. And so I'll have my students line up in the basement. And then we go single file upstairs in a quiet manner. And we do it over again if it doesn't work right the first time. And I'll praise them if it does go right. But anyway, I'll have, 27 students this next year. So I'll have 27 numbers, and I'll put them into a container, and they pull out a number, and that's the number. If whoever gets number one goes first and chooses their desk. And I usually have 5 or 6 rows in the classroom, 4. Anyway, I have my 7th graders in one spot and grade 8 in another and grade 9 and grade 10. And so have that on the chalkboard as to their general area that they're to be sitting. I'll mark on all the desks. Anyway, they go and choose. And they can either choose according to what looks like a good desk, or where they want to be. Some of them will want to be close to the front. Some of them will want to be as far away from me as possible. So they can sit there until the year is about, well, till Christmas time. And then we do a grand switch. And so everybody, those who are sitting at the front, will move either to the middle or to the back. Then in the springtime, we do another third switch. And they don't choose their desk then. That allows me to place students where I choose. And so those who are sitting, you know, next to their friends, that's fine with me as long as they behave themselves. If there's behavior problems, then they know that I can freely relocate them to another spot. So I might give them a warning that that's what's going to happen if misbehavior continues. So remember the value of proximity. Keep students busy. Idle bodies are busy bodies, ironically. So provide worthwhile extra activities, things that are interesting. Add books to the library. Some students really like to do puzzles. Some can be challenged to do additional work, a project, in extra time, supplementary projects. H, provide variety. Some variation, some change. The same thing over, for a long time gets boring. Stand, please. Time to sing. Oh, we're following Jesus. He had wonderful methods and his character was matchless. If you know this little round, it's hard to sing it as a round. We'll just try to sing it. No, that wasn't the song that I taught. It was where there's nothing too hard for thee. That was the one that I had done with some of you. There's nothing too hard for thee, the book from the book of Jeremiah. If you know it, sing it. There's nothing too hard for thee, there's nothing too hard for thee, nothing, no nothing, there's nothing too hard for thee. It's concerning the Lord, let's sing it again. There's nothing too hard for thee, there's nothing too hard for thee, nothing, no nothing, there's nothing too hard for thee. And especially for new teachers, that's pretty valuable observation. Sing it again. There's nothing too hard for thee, there's nothing too hard for thee, nothing, no nothing, there's nothing too hard for thee. Thank you, sit down, that shouldn't be too hard. So, variety. Change of position, singing. Sometimes just in the middle of a lesson, have them go to the chalkboard and we'll have a quick contest or a map contest or some sort of educational activity. Don't keep students in the classroom routinely to finish work. They need the exercise. I will, on a detention, I tend to say, you'll be staying in and you will write out, I must not throw paper wads or whatever it is. And just keep on doing that until I tell you to stop. No, I usually say, until you will remember, henceforth, not to be doing that. So some get done in about 3 minutes, writing out 5 lines, others writing for a long time. Then they come and show it to me, and I confirm with them that that's the end of that misbehavior, and we go on. You can sometimes give surprises. I remember one day it was it was a grammar lesson. We were studying about natural order of sentences and inverted order and mixed order. And so I got, on the spur of the moment, I got 3 boys, one of whom was fairly slight. And so to illustrate the inverted, I turned him upside down. So his head was down there and his feet were up in the air. And I forget what I did with the other one. Probably I had to put his head between his knees or something like that with his hind end sticking up. Anyway, that was the mixed order. So the boys, they loved that sort of thing, and it provided a variety, and they got the point about the order in sentences. Insist on adherence to rules. That's my next point. Try to nip misconduct in the bud. Don't let minor misbehavior develop into something serious. So try to discern when something is going wrong, do something about it rather than waiting till it gets more serious. And part J, be an example of order and self-discipline. So, neat dress. Keep your desk reasonably orderly. Avoid an attitude of laziness, as I told some of you the other day, or carelessness. Don't lose patience. Keep your temper. None of your students want it. We do more good by being good than any other way. We do more good by being good than any other way. Now, there's something else that I thought of after I made up this outline, and that is something that I've done increasingly over the years, and that is to write a note of commendation in terms of preventing problems. And it might be, and some of you may write a note to everyone before school begins in your class. But if I know I'm likely to have difficulty with a student, and on the second day of school they do something really kind, really commendable, I like to write a little note and point that out and express my appreciation to them. And it often will continue on with that they most students, at least to some extent, want to please the teacher unless they have a really rotten attitude toward authority and toward life in general. But I like to write some notes of commendation. I think it's a good prevention of difficulties, and it improves relationships as well. Any comments about any of those or things that you've tried before we go on to corrective discipline? Okay, give you a chance for questions at the end. Some goals now of corrective discipline. God's objectives in chastening us. Well, God's discipline arises out of his love for us. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Hebrews 12:6. So the same way with a teacher. And secondly, God's objective is to help us and develop in us right living and holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Hebrews 12 also. So the teacher's goals, I thought of three. One is to change behavior. A teacher doesn't discipline because the student's actions are an offense, a personal affront, but rather it's to motivate the student to desire to change his conduct or his speech or his attitude, so it's corrective rather than punitive. So it's, we want to build a desire to do better. So if a pupil races down the stairs in such a way that he could crash into another student or hurt himself, consequently he needs to go up and down the stairs 25 times or whatever. The goal is a change in behavior. It's not simply punishment. If a pupil needs to redo sloppy work at home, he will decide to do it properly at school. A second purpose of corrective discipline, second goal, is to warn others. Them that sin rebuke before all, that others also may fear. And so that was the way it was with Mrs. Justice at the beginning. So when one student is punished for an infraction, the rest get the point. Okay, that's not acceptable. If sin is overlooked in a congregation or wherever, then same sort of thing. Them that sin rebuke before all. Not to embarrass the person, but to warn the individual and others who are observing. And thirdly, then, to teach the law of sowing and reaping. Children don't naturally make the connection between choices and consequences. I talked with someone who worked in prison a lot with youth youth offenders. And they said, so many of these, practically invariably, the young person in trouble with the law did not make the connection between the choices that they made and the consequences of that choice. It was always the fault of the parents or the policeman or the court system or whatever it was. And so until they saw the law of sowing and reaping, they tended not to change. Next remedial discipline. At this point, I'm going to ask you to embarrass yourself, possibly, potentially, and tell one of your neighbors about some corrective discipline that you received in school. Now, perhaps some of you have a totally blank slate there as far as any misbehavior, any infraction of a rule at school. So that's fine. I'm not asking you to invent something, or perhaps the Lord has graciously erased those experiences from your memory, and so there's nothing there to say. But go ahead now and tell your neighbors there about something that happened to you by way of a corrective discipline. Go ahead. All right, there's quite a bit of laughter and smiling. I don't imagine that's quite the way it was at the time, but looking back, you can you've learned something, and it's not a bad idea to go back to one of your teachers if you have a teacher that's available, and simply express your appreciation for the discipline. Same idea for parents. It took me a long time till I told my dad. I appreciated a few times that he applauded me with one hand. While I was having a good look at the carpet on the floor. All right, a few ideas about dealing with misbehavior. Be consistent is my first point. Punishment doesn't need to be harsh, but certain. So it's not the severity, but the certainty that makes the difference. It's a certainty, not the severity. Punishment doesn't need to be harsh, but should be certain. And repeat, nip it in the bud. Tell about how your behavior, misbehavior, interferes with the learning of others, the rights of others, how others feel. Thirdly, be observant, be alert, be vigilant. So keep on your toes, guard against complacency. At the same time, don't be always suspicious. I guess this works for teachers too. Suspicious teachers make for sneaky students. I think that's a generalization, but you might think about that. Make the punishment fit the crime in the fourth place. Don't use a sledgehammer to kill a mosquito. Okay? Have a sense of what is appropriate. I go to court with my students. I like sitting in court, actually, if I'm not on the witness stand or accused of something, which I never have been, but there's a lot of similarities between a judge and a principal and a bishop. Terms of fairness and having the punishment fit the crime, and what is true and what isn't true. Fifth, use suggestion. I like the way this group of girls, they're paying such close attention, and they're getting, that's very neat. So everybody else in the, this is grade 3 or something, everybody else wants to be like these girls. So they sharpen up quickly. So, make use of suggestion. I like the way. Employ gentle disapproval, particularly for students that are, you know, basically on your side, and they, for the pupil who derives pleasure from pleasing the teacher, don't overreact. Just, you know, could be a little shake of the head or making a sound. Seventh, relate punishment to the offense. So if they've been throwing stuff around the room, paper airplanes or something, littering the floor, have them sweep the classroom. If they're making black marks on the floor with their shoes, have them scrub the floor, scribbles on the desk, clean all the desks in the room, that sort of thing. Relate the punishment to the offense so that it helps to reinforce that discipline. Eighth, gain support of the class. So we try to use positive peer pressure. So the rest, somebody acts up inappropriately, and the rest of the class says, huh? You know, they're not doing that, but they're thinking that. What's with him? Ninth, deal quickly, but not hastily. So you can say, see me later. Inappropriate punishments or discipline. Don't have that on the outline. I'd like to draw some of these ideas from you. What, in your opinion, would be something that a teacher might consider doing or has done, teachers have done in the past, that you think is highly debatable or questionable or inappropriate? Yes. Okay, the ear thing. My wife, who's a nurse, she said, that is not the right thing. But I know some teachers have done that. And I think I told some of you that Miss Snyder, my grade 7 and 8 music teacher, who thought I should be singing soprano when I thought I should be singing bass, she grabbed me by the hair, and you can see what happens when that... So, and I've heard of some teachers in Christian schools that have, you know, literally yanked the hair. Not a good idea, I don't think. Other inappropriate disciplinary measures? Deliberately embarrassing the child. There's been a few occasions when somebody really was looking for attention, getting attention, and I gave them attention that maybe they sort of the law of sowing and reaping, but generally avoid embarrassing. Your goal is not to embarrass a child. Okay? Yeah. Sometimes just because, you know, I went and stood beside a student and they got a little red, that's sort of embarrassing. Well, a minor sort of point. So. Anything else? Okay, well, come to the matter of corporal punishment, but inappropriate use of corporal punishment and a lack of communication with the parents. Overdoing the spanking route. Yeah. It's been actually several years since I've used corporal punishment with a student at school. We have about 90 students. And when it is done, it tends to be done by the parents. My wife gets rather nervous about me using corporal punishment because the laws of Canada, there's not to be a weapon used. In other words, not a strap or a stick, just parental hand between the ages 2 and 12. So there is some, but I tend to involve the parents, and often the same problem of lying or whatever it is, disrespect, is evident at home, and so I feel it's legitimate then to have the parent work with me on that project. Sarcasm and ridicule is another inappropriate thing. Of course, a punishment that the student likes is not a very appropriate punishment. There was one teacher, all 240 pounds of her, who would yell at the students and so on when there was misbehavior, and ultimately, as her final firepower, she would get up on her desk and blow her whistle. And the students would plot how to get her up on that desk. The most effective, efficient way. All right, let's look at the methods of correction now. give some signals to change. So it might be a detention, or simpler than that, a calling out of the person's name, a shaking of the head, a tap on the shoulder. And Betty Yoder, in her series of lessons about the first days of school, talks about going up the ladder, that, you know, as things increase or the things are repeated, you know, there's more lines, there's more severity to it. Still trying to give signals that the behavior must change. Detentions, I have a particular posture that I insist on my students taking. They sit in their desk, they have their feet flat on the floor, they're facing the front, they're not looking around to see where I am, they have their hands folded like this, not like this. If I see them do it like that, I see one foot ahead of the others, instead of flat on the floor, that all signals to me that they haven't learned their lesson yet, and so they continue to sit there. And if they don't catch on, then I remind them of how they're supposed to be, until they eventually do. So, detentions, lines, and extra work. Embarrassment, yeah, rare. Then there can be a visit with the principal, which can be rather intimidating if they haven't had that much to do with the principal. Of course, if the principal is also the teacher, it's not too much different. Not sure whether to put 3 or 6 first, talk to the parents or corporal punishment, but where there is corporal punishment, there should be a witness. I always like to tell the parents first and make sure I have their support. Needs to be reasonable force used. Should be an understanding with the parents and the board. Different ways of actually carrying it out from community to community. And if you're responsible for corporal punishment, then be sure you have an understanding with the board. Number 4 is prayer. If the person is a Christian, then you have a basis of appeal for improved behavior. Might be a long-term removal of privilege. And one thing that I've found, particularly with 13, 14, 15-year-olds that I deal with, is if it is a serious attitude problem, then most of my students love to play games and be outside at recess time, but I'll have the student instead walk, without talking, around the playground. We have a big playground. And so it can take them 3 minutes at least to walk around. And all recess time, they walk and they walk and they walk. And at noon hour, as soon as they're done eating their lunch, they walk. And they can watch the others having a good time playing. And they walk. And sometimes it's all day and sometimes it's all week. And eventually they get the message. It's always worked at this point for me. Ultimately then, suspension. If they want to return to school, I usually want a signed letter from them saying that they will fully cooperate. And finally, there's expulsion. If that's with the support of the board, the understanding of the parents. And that's a sad thing. I've had very few of those, but I've had more suspensions. Have you any questions in the last couple of minutes that we have? Sorry, I didn't get the question.
You recommend taking care of it the same day it happens, if not over the student and the teacher?
If possible, look after discipline the same day. The closer to the time of the offense, normally the better it is. Particularly with younger children, they start to forget what the connection here is, but sometimes it's difficult to, and sometimes you have to communicate with parents, particularly if it's a serious thing.
How do you determine, you talk about the children that have maybe health issues and that type of thing? You don't want to be, you know, some of those things we don't know.
True, we don't always know that we're not medical practitioners. Usually parents will tell you. Or if there is a kidney problem where they have to run to the bathroom a lot, then be understanding of that and have an understanding that they can go whenever they need to. Mm-hmm.
All right, hope this has been helpful to you. And, discipline is something that a lot of teachers dread, disciplinary problems. But a well-ordered classroom is a joy to visit and a joy to teach in. And I wish you the best in the coming year. God bless you all. Thank you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.